This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
So good afternoon and welcome to the National Museum of Australia. My name is John Lanine. I'm one of the curators here. And I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet and pay respect to their elders past and present. Welcome. Welcome to our A History of the World in 100 Objects lecture series. From the Big Bang through to early civilizations and the rise of empire, we now focus our attention on the time before the New World. Dr. Claudia Hacke from La Trobe University and Dr. John Minns from ANU will be taking us on a journey through the history of the Incas' pre-conquest to Aztec society and through to Muslim Spain. So what's going to happen to this afternoon is John is going to come up and speak, then Claudia is going to come up and speak, and then we're going to sit down after that and save your questions until all three of us are up on the stage after that. A little bit of housekeeping, if you can put your mobiles onto silent, that would be great. So our first speaker is Dr. John Minns from the ANU. John is Associate Professor in Politics and International Relations and was Director of the Australian National Centre for Latin American Studies from 2007 to 2016. His research focuses on the political economy of developing countries in Latin America. He is a former Fulbright Scholar and University Medalist and has won numerous teaching awards. Please join me in welcoming John to the stage.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the museum for giving me the opportunity to talk about the Golden Llama. Because it gives me the opportunity to talk about one of the most interesting civilizations and one of the most important empires in the pre-New World period, that of the Incas. The Golden Llama itself is an interesting object in a few ways because it tells us a few things about the society that created it. One, just the fact that it is a llama is quite important because, as I'm sure you know, there were no, before European contact, there were no heavy draft animals, oxen or horses that could carry loads or pull plows in the New World. And the llama was for the Inca people and the empire which they created, an extraordinarily important animal because it was able to carry not very heavy loads, perhaps only 20 or 30 kilos at the most, but it was able to do so across a very, very difficult terrain in the Andes in particular, and it was also able to withstand very high altitudes, 3,000 metres and more in the Andes, and carry those packs. And probably without the llama, it would have been very, very difficult for the Inca to establish an empire and the kind of society, very sophisticated society, that they managed to do. Secondly, the fact that it's gold is quite important because gold was, of course, bound up in this whole story of the Old World and the New World. For the Inca people and for people throughout this region, gold was something close to a sacred metal. The main deity for the Inca was the sun, the sun god Inti, and the gold was considered to be in some ways derivative of the sun, the sweat of the sun perhaps because of its golden rays and so on. And it was very important as a form therefore of worship and also in civil society. Gold was really owned increasingly by the period at which the Europeans arrived, was owned by the central king, the Sapa Inca of Inca society. And of course, gold was one of the great two motivating forces of the Europeans, of the Spanish, in coming to the New World in the first place, the other being souls, but gold, I think, really trumped it more than anything. And perhaps the third thing that's interesting about this quite small object, if you've seen it, is that it was very possibly an object of tribute, that it was created by not the Inca people themselves, but by a conquered people and paid to the Inca in tribute, which tells you something about the nature of the empire that the Inca had created. It was a huge empire, and as I say, it spans a number of countries that I've listed here in modern political terms. It was, at that point, the largest north-south empire in history, 5,500 kilometres, and across, as I said, extremely difficult terrain in the Andes. It was a place of great diversity. There were probably 30 languages or more in the empire at its height. And it's hard to know, but at least 10 million subjects of empire, possibly as many as 16 million at its height. Now, to put that in some sort of world comparison, Spain, the conqueror of this region at the time, probably had about 7 million, a population of about 7 million. And that was one of the more populated countries of Europe at the time. So this is a vast empire, both in terms of numbers of people, in terms of its geographical spread, and the fact that it incorporated such a diverse range of societies, of cultures, of tongues. Here it is, and it gives you an idea. Quito, the northern capital, to a little further south of Santiago. There's some controversy about how far south the Incas actually got, but probably somewhere in that range. Of course, it's difficult to conceive of why the Incas didn't go further to the east and start to push further into Argentina, Bolivia, Peru, and so on. And eventually, there are geographical problems with it. But the major ones that prevented the Incas from spreading east, I'd say, were the kinds of societies that they encountered there. In the Andes, what you encountered were fairly urbanized societies in many cases, civilizations which were quite well developed, which had well-established agriculture, and therefore could provide tribute. Therefore, they were worthwhile conquering. When you start to get into the Brazilian, the Amazonian jungle, it becomes very difficult going, and what you actually get for the conquest starts to decline. So it becomes a real barrier, social barrier, as well as a topographical barrier for the Incas. Okay, so let's have a look at the geography of the place, because this in many ways shapes important things about Inca society and the empire that they create. It is an extremely rugged and difficult terrain. Even today, there's talk about creating a highway across the Andes, and that's become extraordinarily difficult to do, even with modern engineering technology and so on. The Inca, of course, had roads, but even so, without horses, for example, communication across this area is quite difficult. This is the kind of topography that lends itself to two things, I think. One is that you tend to get very different sorts of climates depending on exactly where you are. And you could be quite close in terms of latitude to another area with quite a different series of cultivars, quite a different series of plants. And that, in turn, lends itself to densely populated areas, because it's quite fertile, this area, but also areas which are separated from each other, squabbling polities almost within sight of each other, or within one mountain range or valley of each other away. Actually, I think it's quite similar in the case of Aztec society around the Central Valley of Mexico, around the lake system there. Now, the origins of this civilization in this area had developed long before the Incas, of course, and in some ways the Incas are very much Johnny-come-latelys in this area. The great classic civilization that civilizations to follow in the Andes looked to was Tiahuanaco, which rose about 500 AD and for about another 500 years. The Incas and other civilizations in this area looked to Tiahuanaco as the kind of classic civilization from which they drew much of their culture. For example, worship of the sun as the central deity. I suppose, it's sort of, in a way, the way in which Europeans look to classic, the classic period of Greece and Rome, this is the way in which the Andean peoples looked at Tiahuanaco. But because of the range of different polities, you have a series of empires, not really even empires, but civilizations rising and falling in conflict with each other. And it's not really until quite late in the piece that the Incas come to dominate in that region. One of the things that I'll mention here, a preceding civilization to the Incas, is Chimú, which is quite important. It lasts up until the beginning of Inca expansion, the beginnings of the Inca Empire around 1450, from about 850. One of the key things that comes out of Chimú and that the Incas take over is the idea of split inheritance of kings. increasingly in these societies, kingship becomes divine. The Sapa Inca, the head Inca, the only Inca, the king of the Incas, becomes increasingly godlike over time. And as that happens, as he becomes a deity, the question then appears, what happens when physically he actually dies? He's not really dead because gods can't die. And if gods can't die and the Sapa Inca is actually still alive, then to take his property is stealing from the gods, is robbing the gods, and is clearly sacrilegious. So what Chimur establishes for the first time, and the Incas inherit now, is this idea that a new Inca will take the place of the dead Inca, but the property of the dead Inca will always remain in trust for him, rather than for the new one. This has very important implications that I'll talk about in a moment in terms of the expansion of the Inca Empire. As I mentioned, this society began to become more centralized over a period of a couple of hundred years. What begins in kingship as a fairly elective position of war leader, or the cinchi, becomes increasingly a hereditary position, and it becomes more and more powerful. In other words, the state starts to become the most important institution in Inca society. Kingship becomes the center of the state, and the state becomes more and more dominant. So Inca society is not something that's frozen in time. It's developing. It's changing over the couple of hundred years before the Europeans get there and moving in this direction. It's an economy which is based on llama tending, potatoes, of course, a huge variety of potatoes grown in the region, and over hundreds of years developed from tiny little tubers up into the sizable sort of ones that we see today, but a huge variety even today. The Quechua language, the language of the Inca, is spread throughout the region as the empire develops, and it becomes a fairly statized economy. The state intervenes in the economy, demanding tribute from different social groups, from clan groups in the economy. Tribute can come in a variety of forms. It can come in material forms of food and so on, and it can also come, and most importantly, it can come in terms of labour. The Sapa Inca is the ruler of the kingdom. The Inca state then is multicellular, made up of clan groups called the Ayu, a village clan, usually related to each other, owing tribute to the central state. Taking it in turns through this institution called the Mita to provide labour to keep the state running and to build those extraordinary cities, those great walls, the roads, the terraces for agriculture that no doubt you've seen. The religion of the Inca is based around the most important deity. There are many deities. The most important deity is the sun. And as with many American religions, the single deity can have different facets depending on what's happening. So one aspect of the sun god is Viracocha, who is the creator of the world, is an aspect of the sun. The other sort of more day-to-day god running things is Inti, the central god, really, probably venerated by the Inca. But there are also very many sacred objects. And golden objects can become sacred objects in this context as well, and very possibly the golden llama was one of these. But they were called huacas. Huacas could be oddly shaped stones. They could be all sorts of physical objects which people in this society thought in some way embodied holiness, in some way represented the sacredness of nature, of the world. The most sacred objects were the remains of ancestors. And so throughout this whole region, mummification of the dead becomes a central practice of religious practice. And so there are many, many mummies, of course, that archaeologists have discovered in the Andes as a result. The most sacred of mummies, or malquis, are in fact the mummies of the Inca, the Sapa Inca, the king, because these are the mummified remains of a god. Okay, we might have to hurry up. So, we tend, I think, wrongly with civilizations which are encountered by the West and which then collapse, or at least their polity collapses, the state collapses very rapidly, we tend to think of them as ancient organizations. In fact, the Inca were not an ancient civilization at all. This empire was created really only in 1438. The Inca expansion from their initial very small base around the city of Cusco is very rapid, but it really lasts for less than a century by the time the Spanish get there, 90-something years. They called it Tahuantinsuyu, or land of the four quarters, and these are the four areas that they make up those quarters. Oh, what happened? Okay. As I said, Inca society for several hundred years is becoming more centralized. Kingship is becoming more important. And with that, the role of war, of warriors, is becoming more important in that society. And the role of the clan organization in determining what happens in people's lives, the IU, is becoming less important. It's an old saying, observation about empire in general, that some of the first victims of imperial expansion are the commoners in the society that's doing the expansion. And that's also the case here with the Inca. The central state is wielding more and more power, sucking more and more resources from the IU, determining what's happening increasingly as it becomes more centralized, more warlike, and more expansionist. And that expansion begins with an Inca called Pachacuti, whose name means something like he who remakes the world, or a turning upside down of the world, a cataclysm, turning things upside down. He begins the expansion with defeating another society called Chanca, the Chanca just around Cusco. Now, to go back to this notion of split inheritance, the idea that when the Sapa Inca dies, as a god, he's not really dead and therefore must still own his property. Who actually looks after that property? The people who do so, the organization that does so, is called the Panaca. The Panaca is a group of, I suppose, the royal court of the Inca in life. They usually are related, usually male relatives of the Sapa Inca. And in life, they are the immediate support group for the Inca. In death, they maintain the dead Inca's property on his behalf. So the Panaca becomes a very, very important institution because in real life, they're in control of significant land, of buildings, of wealth, and of rights to tribute from the IU that the dead Inca had owned in life. An increasingly important institution is the Panaca. Now, probably the first Inca really is the Sapa Inca around about 1200 with Manco Capac. And then there are a series of Incas before Pachacuti. But the period of imperial expansion really only has four or five Sapa Incas before Atahualpa, the last of the effective rulers of the Inca Empire, is killed by the Spanish. So it's a very short-term empire, rapid expansion, but it doesn't last very long. Now, the Huacas, in particular the mummies, are very important for the afterlife. Atahualpa, for example, who is eventually killed by the Spanish, is given the choice of maintaining his existing religion and being burnt at the stake, or converting to Christianity, at least nominally, and being garrotted. And he chose the latter. The Spanish are very fair about these things. Atahualpa chose the latter, being garrotted rather than being burnt, not perhaps because he thought it a nicer way to die, but because burning would mean it would be possible to preserve his body, to mummify his body, and that is going to be crucial for the afterlife. So the mummies are extraordinarily important. Now, Inca expansion, again, I think we can understand some aspects of it, some of the motivations for that expansion, because of the system of split inheritance. Because what split inheritance means is that every new Inca inherits the position but no wealth. And with no wealth, no land, no rights to tribute, no buildings, no palaces, etc., with none of that available, how does he get it? How can he maintain a panaka to preserve his mummy in death, to preserve his remains, so important for the afterlife? The only way the new Inca can do so is by expanding the territory under control. It can't come from anywhere else. And so the system of split inheritance gives the military impulses to expand the empire rapidly a huge boost. And it's why we see in such a short period of time, I think, such a dynamic expansion of this empire. There are other people who benefit, of course, from the expansion. The Panakas, each new Panaka benefits because the new territories are under their control, even when that Inca dies. There are military leaders and so on who can move up now in society. The military become a more revered part of Inca society as the imperial expansion takes place. And all of this, you have to remember, takes place in a society where there is no division between politics, society, economy, and religion. These are all one and the same. The divinity of the Sapir Inca is crucial to the state and politics, but it's also centrally involved in the operation of the economy through tribute, through the meter, through labour tribute, and so on. Now, there are some problems with the system. I've lost the name there. One is a problem that exists with all empire, I think, and that's a problem of expansion imposes costs on the empire that does expand. And the more you expand, the more difficult that becomes. You have to have a huge army. The last army of Atahualpa, for example, possibly had 250,000 men in it. That has to be maintained as a standing army which does not produce the means of subsistence, of food and so on. It's a cost, a huge burden on the productive forces of that society. Secondly, as I said, expansion becomes more difficult, particularly expansion to the east, for the reasons that I mentioned before. You start to run into jungle, you start to run into people who, in many cases, are not settled agriculturalists. Therefore, it's very difficult to get any tribute from them or to use their labour productively in the way that you can with the settled, the larger societies of the Andes when they're conquered. Thirdly, just the distance, in that this period of technology becomes extraordinarily difficult to maintain a coherent, cohesive, held-together empire with messengers, the Shaskis, runners, doing relays. You could cover 2 to 250 kilometres in a day. There was no written language for the Incas, so either these were verbal messages that were being passed, or, very importantly, they used a system called the quipus, which I've illustrated here, but had some copies of them here. These are an intricate system of knotted cords which carry messages, particularly numerical messages. For example, the number of people who are providing tribute, or the number of lamas, or whatever it is, the number of soldiers, quite often using different colours to indicate the kind of thing that you're talking about, and then knots in those cords to indicate the numbers themselves. They used the base 10 system as well, so it was quite easy to read the numbers. But even so, across an empire of this size, to hold Cusco in constant communication with Quito in the north is always going to be a challenge. And so there are going to be separatist tendencies that are starting to develop in this empire. Another problem is that each time the empire expands, the best land is monopolized by the new Inca, who has no property, has to recreate it in order to recreate the Panaka and so on. Also, as the empire expands and it becomes more difficult to find new productive land, one of the things that Inca society does is to use projects to try to increase the productivity of that land. And so, of course, you will have seen photos of the extraordinary terracing that's done on very steep hillsides in order to create more land. This is an engineering marvel, But it also illustrates the shortage of land that's developing, because it takes enormous amounts of labour, investment in labour, in order to create that terracing, at reclamation projects and so on. But as time goes on, this becomes more and more difficult to do. So stresses and strains are starting to emerge inside Inca society. Another problem is the Panakas themselves, because the Panaka's loyalty is to a dead king rather than to the existing one, to the existing Sapa Inca. And therefore, the system has built into itself a kind of permanent factionalism rather than a system where loyalty is to the existing state primarily. Another problem is that the Incas, unlike the Aztecs actually, actually have a policy of moving populations around to sustain loyalty, of ethnic cleansing, if you like. And they move populations who are loyal to them into areas where they feel possibly rebellious. This too creates problems in the area, because these cultural differences, colonists settled in areas that they don't come from, they don't speak the same language, they take over land in the new areas, creates, again, rebellious ideas. Now, the collapse when it comes is very rapid. These are some of the weaknesses in the Inca Empire. Huayna Capac, an Inca, dies in 1525, probably of smallpox, which is, of course, a European disease, not unknown in the Americas until the Europeans arrive. Huayna Capac never saw a European, never met a European. But the Europeans had passed smallpox through a chain of people. So even before they get there to the Inca Empire, people are starting to die of smallpox. There's another factor which I just... Sorry I'm going on a little bit. I must tell you about this, because this is a crucial factor as well in the collapse of the Inca Empire. You think, if the king is divine, is God, then what happens when a divine being, a god, marries a mere mortal and has a child? The child can only be half a god, a demigod, rather than fully divine. So eventually, the system that's adopted, the belief that's adopted, is that a legitimate heir of the Inca can only be the product of an incestuous marriage between the Inca and his sister. At the end, the empire is divided between two factions, one of whom, Huasca, is a legitimate heir in that he's the product of Huayna Capac and his sister, and Atahualpa, who's the product of, and a much more able, as you might imagine, heir, who's the product of Huayna Capac and another woman, and not divine. Atahualpa and Huasca fight. It's essentially between the north and the centre-south of the system. There's a civil war which lasts 3 years, in which hundreds of thousands of people in this empire divide. And that's when Pizarro enters, at the weakest point, at the point where it's in crisis, in long-term decline, and in immediate crisis. With only 263, he captures Atahualpa at a place called Cayamarca, a famous point of meeting. The Spanish actually promise to release Atahualpa if he can fill a room with gold, the room in which he's imprisoned, and he manages to do that, but they execute him anyway. As I say, the Pizarros were not nice people. Look, I'll leave the reasons why Spain won, perhaps, to the discussion, but let's think about a variety of reasons, most of which are not technological, most of which have to do with the inbuilt weaknesses of Inca society itself. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, John. That was, we could have gone on for hours there, I think. That was fascinating. But I'd now like to welcome Dr. Claudia Hacke to the stage from La Trobe University. Claudia joined the history program at La Trobe in 2007 after lecturing in the UK and Germany. Her main research interest is Native American history, ethnicity, identity, and culture. Claudia is also interested in land and treaty rights in the United States and the history of 20th century Guatemala. Welcome to the stage, Claudia.
I'll be talking to you about some of those reasons that John didn't have time for, so that works out just fine. Okay. A bit of a lengthy title, Aztec Mexica, The Rise and Fall of an Empire. And the reason I'm going to talk about the fall of the empire, slightly pushing the brief, is because it has an impact on what we know about the Aztec Empire itself, and especially about the conquest period. This is the object in the exhibit, which is of Aztec origin. And you've probably seen the exhibit and know that it's the malevolent spirit of a woman who died in childbirth, was equated in the Aztec religion with the spirits of men who died in battle. It may once have been part of a roadside shrine intended to prevent children from the spirits who descended to earth for 5 days of a year, and those were days of ill fortune. These spirits maimed and killed, they preferred maiming, and the preferred targets were children. Now, to some of us today, the most striking thing about this carving is probably the depiction of female violence. However, as you probably already know, and I will talk some more about this shortly, violence was an integral part of Aztec society. And there's also some fairly obvious parallels that can be drawn to, say, witches in European societies and cultures. The most striking thing, and again, we have some wonderful parallels to what John has been talking about, is really the age of this carving, which could potentially even have been contemporaneous with the conquest of Mexico itself, which was from 1519 to 1521. So, you know, if it was at the end of his period, it may have been after Cortes had already landed and started his campaign. So the story I'll tell shortly, starting with a little puzzle for you. Sorry, I have to do this for my students. I got into the habit. Is one that goes back in time further for the brief moment I'll be talking about Europe than it does about the Aztec. And I will mostly talk about Europe to explain especially why the European-produced sources on which we draw for some of our knowledge were so unreliable and created enduring myths which have proven very hard to dispel. So here's the puzzle. What do these two pictures have to do with one another? Who is that in the second image? What does he have to do with Aztecs, Aztec art? And what can he tell us about the fact that the Spaniards emerged as victorious over the great Aztec empires? And I was particularly excited going through the exhibit earlier to see that this person, who's a painter, has one image in this exhibit as well. I don't want answers to all the questions, but does anyone know who the man on the right-hand side picture is? Dürer, very good. But of course, you know the exhibit. So, get it. Okay. But he lets everyone else off the hook. So it's Albrecht Dürer. And for the rest of the answers, I'll keep those until fairly to the end of the presentation. According to Aztec tales, Tenochtitlan, the great city, which is today Mexico, was actually less than 200 years old. Until then, the Mexica, as the Aztecs were also called, and who already appear to have spoken Nahuatl when they reached the Valley of Mexico in their migrations, were wanderers, really existing at the margins, tolerated at best, and repeatedly displaced when they weren't wanted. They're people without a place and without a home, which was a great anomaly in the Valley of Mexico. Eventually, after being displaced again, they came to a swampy island where, the legend goes, they saw an eagle sitting on an opal cactus with feathers of birds scattered around underneath. And a version of this image, as you can see, is still in the Mexican coat of arms today. The snake is actually not something that features in the Aztec codices. The eagle represented the sun god, the main deity again, and scholars have suggested that the red fruit of an opal cactus, which you can see here, is looked to the Aztecs like the stylized human hearts in the books they had been carrying around on their migration. They slowly gained a foothold in that area, but had to pay tribute to the city of, this is one of the Nahuatl terms that I find most difficult to pronounce, Azcapotzalco, which was dominant at the time. So they finally had a place, but they had to pay tribute. In 1428, the Mexica then allied with Texcoco and Tacuba and overthrew this city to which they'd been paying tribute. And only one generation later, this is a pretty rapid rise, the first Moctezuma and his allies controlled most of the Valley of Mexico. In 1402 then, Moctezuma the Younger ascended to the throne, and by then the Mexica were pretty much the dominant power in this alliance, and most of the neighbors had been subjugated and now had to pay tribute to the alliance. Local leaders were in this situation usually left in place as long as they paid tribute. And this is probably what the Aztec Empire looked like at its largest extent. Now, I'm just going to call your attention to... Wrong button. Where's the right button? I need to come around, otherwise I can't see. Tlaxcala here, and Quetzaltlan over there, which will feature in the next story. Because... the Aztec Empire was not, say, like the Roman Empire, something that had garrisons all over the place. As long as the areas that had been subjected paid their tribute, they were pretty much left alone and the local leaders left in place. However, this was not always the case. During the reign of Moctezuma the Elder, this city over here, probably incited by Tlaxcala, which was not tribute-paying, decided to defy Tenochtitlan and the Aztec and not pay tribute. So when the Mexica emissaries arrived to collect the tribute, the people of the city killed them, stuffed their bodies with straw, set them up in seats of honor, and paid very exaggerated reverence to them. And this was really, really bad snub to the Aztecs. They then moved in and militarily subjugated the town and increased the tribute, doubled it, in fact. But the punishment went beyond this, as the Mexica also demanded symbolical tribute, including live snakes. Just imagine how miserable it must have been to catch those for the tribute collectors, you know, wriggling through areas with a snake stick and trying to catch the quota you were expected to present the tribute collectors with. The Mexica didn't even have real use for all of the tribute they demanded. You know, they could also ask for spiders or scorpions. But this was done to prove a point. They were in charge, the others were not. In the meantime, thriving on tribute like this, the city of Tenochtitlan grew. By the time of the Spaniards' arrival, there was a central zone, and this is sort of a recreated image of what the central zone may have looked like, surrounded by other buildings. And the lordly houses could well be two stories with internal courtyards and gardens, but the humbler dwellings of the commoners were more likely one story with maybe some plantings on the roofs. What the Spaniards found striking when they arrived is how clean and tidy the city was. Boys from the warrior houses were tasked with sweeping, and there were small latrines over boats, which also meant that you could carry the waste away to use as fertilizer on the very scarce agricultural lands. City had also vivid colors, as I think you can see in that image, this crimson and blue. At the time of the arrival of Cortes and his group, there are about 200,000 inhabitants of Tenochtitlan. And you could compare that to the 60 or 70,000 that Seville had at about the same time. And this was the biggest city in Spain and also the last, one of the last likely that the Spaniards had encountered before leaving the country. There were beggars in the street, which, you know, Cortes actually saw as a sign of civility because this was like in Spain, so it must be right. Cortes, in describing Tenochtitlan, wrote to the Spanish Emperor, Charles, that Moctezuma lived in a palace, and I quote, so marvelous that it seems to me impossible to describe its excellence and grandeur. In Spain, there is nothing to compare it with. And he then added three pages of closer description, so it seems it must have been possible, after all, to describe it. What Cortes sought to do was to show the emperor how desirable it was to add this marvel to his crown. Cortez, we must remember because I haven't told you actually yet, was a bit of a renegade, and he hoped that the end result would redeem him in the eyes of the king and Spain, and also to make him rich. Now, Tenochtitlan was in many ways a city of warriors, and for them, like other dress and adornments, were a sign of status. It was very strictly regulated, especially what warriors could wear, but also what commoners and nobles could wear. To be born male in Tenochtitlan was to be designated a warrior. All young males were exposed to warrior training. Some then later could become something else, for instance, priests, but they're all trained. Success of a warrior was measured by the number and status of enemy warriors taken alive in one-on-one combat. And if someone excelled at doing this, and, you know, having, say, provide three captives like this was considered to be quite a good number and meant you could start training others. And if you were really a good warrior, this could also open a, you know, path into nobility, which was the only way. Now, the captives that were thus obtained were needed for sacrifice. And now, this was very important. Human sacrifices is what the Aztecs wanted. Animals wouldn't ordinarily do. Sacrificing someone was not a denial of humanity. They were sacrificed specifically because they were humans. So the objective of war was not, as in many, many other places, simply to kill the enemy. It's quite the contrary. Killing would be failure. Okay, so that is a brief and admittedly rather sketchy description of the state of the Aztec Empire at the eve of the arrival of the Spaniards. It had not existed for all that long. I'll briefly recap that before I talk about the Spanish arrivals. Tenochtitlan founded in about 1325. Only 100 years later, an alliance lost subject status. 50 years after that, they're pretty much ready to push beyond the Valley of Mexico. And then 50 years of imperial splendor, massive elaboration of Tenochtitlan during this time. And if you think about it in generational terms, a man whose grandfather had actually fought in other people's wars as a hireling in the early days of the Mexica and the Valley would have seen the glory of his empire rise, and then his own son would witness the destruction. And the destruction came with Hernán Cortés. Cortés came as one of the strangers from beyond the mists, as the Aztecs referred to anyone beyond, from beyond the ocean, a people without a city, an anomaly. He came, or Cortés and Moctezuma met on the 8th of November, 1519. And this is an event scholars have referred to as the birth of modern history. Adam Smith and Karl Marx don't quite agree. They say it was Columbus making landfall, but I think this meeting between Cortés and Moctezuma has a better claim than that. Sadly, we know relatively little about what actually happened at the time, at this meeting. There are very few sources, actually only one from the time. And this one, Cortés' letters, this is the most important one we have. But he was not always the most reliable witness, to put it mildly. However, it was the only set of documents that was actually written at the time. Interestingly, Cortés himself never claimed to have been a god or been considered a god by the Aztecs. And ironically, this is one of the most enduring myths about this conquest. Some of you may have heard about it. The origin of a myth that the Aztecs took Cortés to be the god Quetzalcoatl did not thus originate with Cortés himself. The myth of the Spaniards, and especially Cortés, being taken to be gods was actually not of Spanish origin, even though some other Spaniards who'd been part of a group of a conquering force wrote accounts later which largely corroborated what Cortés has done. And I will come back to these in a moment. Then there were the writings of priests who were in the area reasonably early on and collected Indian testimonies. Most notable among these men was Fray Bernardo de Sahagún. But the Indian voices were not from the Conquest period or even its immediate aftermath. But really, these were collected from about 1540 onwards, so you know, a good 20 years after the fact. And one of the resulting works out of this is the Florentine Codex, from which you can see an image from a conquest period of a conquest here. And this was Sahagún, who wrote parts in Spanish, and the bits in Nahuatl were written by his indigenous aides. These men doing the bits in Nahuatl would have been young at the time of conquest and were most likely the sons of nobles. And it seems likely that, you know, looking back, they sought to find particular auguries associated with the conquest to explain to themselves what had happened, how their mighty empire could possibly have fallen, and fallen to so relatively few men. So this is an image of Quetzalcoatl from another codex. The story about Quetzalcoatl's promised return of, you know, a white god, which then came to be told as Cortes being mistaken for this god, likely originated with Florentine codex. And several stories were conflated in this. It was the result of the Indians trying to justify to themselves what had happened. So while this particular myth did not originate with Cortes, others did. Most importantly, the idea that Moctezuma submitted to him and the Spanish crown voluntarily. And here's an image of Moctezuma. According to Cortes' account from his letters to the king, the same evening that they met, Moctezuma handed over his entire dominions to Cortes and through him to Charles V, Holy Roman Emperor. The Spaniards were nice enough to secure the submission by arresting him. This, several scholars have suggested, was unlikely to have happened. Spaniards, it seems, were actually granted access to the city to appreciate Moctezuma's greatness, and so the Aztecs could find out more about them. Moctezuma had previously sent painters to record numbers of men, deer, as in horses, and boats. And these pictures, which the Spaniards saw, were seen by them as quaint, but likely had a military objective. Moctezuma had also gathered other intelligence, for instance, about the sermon the Spaniards preached along the way, which, when they arrived in Tenochtitlan, Moctezuma asked them not to repeat, as he knew it so well. So, you know, he had obviously studied the Spaniards quite closely. He may also have decided to invite the Spaniards into the city because he realized that the Aztecs might not be able to achieve victory over them in open country. It is unlikely that the Spaniards seized Moctezuma when Cortes claimed they did in November 1519, but he certainly was arrested before the end of April 1520. More likely, until about that time, the Spaniards had actually been in the city as guests or visitors. Remember that Cortes appealed directly to the king to be recognized as conqueror of the mainland and thus reap the rewards of his conquest, instead of going through his sponsor, whose brief he hadn't adhered to anyway. So, you know, he couldn't go back. He would likely be punished. The only chance he had of coming out of this alive and rich was by appealing to the king. So this is why Cortes' story of Moctezuma's voluntary submission to the crown was important, as it justified the actions Cortes had taken without permission and also for a legalistic reason. The crown could only annex territories that came voluntarily or through a just war. So in this case, you know, it would have been voluntary in the first instance. Later writers corroborated Cortes' account as they had all read his letters and also had other compelling motives to do so. Bernal Diaz de Castillo, for instance, who had been a soldier with Cortes, wrote his book, his memoirs, when he was in Spain in 1540 to advance a claim for a permanent encomienda, an allotment of indigenous workers, as one of the original conquistadors. So it was in his best interest to portray the war with the Aztecs as a just one for which he needed to be rewarded. And I will come back to the notion of a just war shortly. Other letters by Cortes tell a story of being attacked and fleeing from Tenochtitlan, losing many men in the process, returning to lay siege to the city with native allies, and in its bare bones, that is correct. But the reason why the Spanish prevailed were likely more complex than these common mythical tales have led us to believe. It appears from recent scholarship that, in actual fact, the reason why Spaniards triumphed were much more complex, and it had nothing to do with Moctezuma taking them to be God. In fact, the Aztecs even appear to have changed their practice about taking captives, and here's a skull rack, which was traditionally used, and started to not take the Spaniards or their native allies captive anymore, but especially the Spaniards they killed on the battlefield, and they killed them with a blow to the back of the head, like was customary for killing criminals. Smallpox had weakened the Mexica. The Spaniards had returned with allies, and they had been resupplied. And there were some technical superiorities. How well they worked out really likely depended on where the fights were actually happening. And it may have been, in part, the ability to get reinforcement and supplies quickly. And several more ships with supplies arrived by mid-1520. And word also spread through the printing press. Nonetheless, it was likely a very close matter in terms of who won this. This takes me back to my question from the beginning. Here is Albrecht Dürer, and he had actually seen an exhibit of Aztec art in Brussels in, and this is the amazing thing, July of 1520. So while the conquest was still very much ongoing, Cortes had already shipped treasures from the Aztec, including art, over to Europe, and people like Dürer saw it. So this shows us how fast the word spread. However, apart from faster reinforcements, funding, resupplies, etc., this also meant more scrutiny. And especially, you know, the English were always keen to spread the leyenda negra, the black legend of Spanish treatment of the Indians, which was particularly bad. And this meant that Cortes and others had to be very mindful to be seen to be doing the right thing. Hence their focus on only waging just wars and following the required procedures. And this goes back to Muslim rule over Spain, which had started in 800, and Muslims had conquered pretty much all of Spain up into France. And there was a slow and very drawn-out reconquest. Now, when the Muslims conquered Spain, there was a specific procedure which required that a messenger be sent and first ask the enemies to submit. If they then didn't, then, you know, loss of lives and blood was on them and not on the attackers. This was a protocol for conquest, which they developed. When the Spaniards reconquered Spain slowly, they followed this example with something they called it. And this practice was translated into the New World, was spread into the New World, and a document was created in 1512. And this came to be called a protocol for conquest. And it was simply something that the Spaniards were used to. This was how things were done. This is what they knew. It was, of course, read in Spanish, and often out of earshot of whichever group of natives they were attacking. So, you know, the practical value was zilch. But nonetheless, it was a legal requirement to do this. Basic idea behind it was that if the natives had not been exposed to the Catholic faith, they had to be given a chance to accept it and to submit. If they refused, they could then be attacked and conquered, and it wouldn't be on the Spaniards' conscience. So fulfilling such legal procedures was just many of the concerns that influenced those who created the sources we have drawn on for knowledge about the conquest and even the pre-conquest period when it came to descriptions of the Aztecs. So ironically, even though we have European accounts of a conquest, and these tend to be regarded as more reliable than indigenous ones, we know relatively little through them directly, and they have been a source of enduring myths rather than more clarity, and they were created by Europeans such as Cortes, who were very much products of their time and had their own personal interests at heart. So in some ways, what we do know now about the Aztecs pre-conquest and at the time of conquest, pre-conquest, while at times hard to come by, is almost more reliable than the conquest period. And what we know from Cortes and others has also clouded our knowledge of the pre-conquest era. And this takes me back to the starting point, the beautiful object, one of many that have brought us all here, and this is things like this, objects like this, are just some of the sources we can draw on for knowledge about the Aztecs, which may well be more reliable than what Cortés and others have said. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'm going to invite John and Claudia up to the stage now. We've just got a few minutes. We've gone a little bit over time here. But if anybody has any questions, now would be the time. And just wait for the mic, Janine. Come on. Hello?
Good afternoon. Thank you for the talk. I'm Rabina. I was lucky enough to study history at La Trobe at its heyday, when it was the heart of its Latin American studies and all of that. So, and I lament the fact that history at La Trobe and other universities is no longer taught, because I think that some of our politicians, in the light of the events of this week, could learn a lot from past events. That's the context of my question. And in view of that sort of context, I was wondering if you could see how we can better use these sorts of lessons from history to inform our politicians and governments about policy. I know it's a bit broader than your brief, but I thought Sunday afternoon in Canberra, what else, you know?
Incestuous marriages?
Yeah.
Well, I can see Donald Trump as a kind of Francisco Pizarro.
But, yes.
I can see some parallels there. The problem is I can't see him sitting through one of these lectures. That's that part of the problem. Look, I think, you know, as Claudia said, this is one of the critical points in world history. I think there's a Spanish historian who talks about the history of the world as, for a very long period, it's people spreading out across the world, you know, starting in Africa, Europe, across the Asian landmass, into the Americas and so on. 1492 is the point where it comes together. And it's, in a sense, it informs a whole lot of debates. We talk about globalization. In a sense, this is such a critical phase in the process of globalization and intercultural mixing. It has all sorts of lessons, I think, for how civilizations meet, for imperialism, for questions about the dominance of one part of the world to the other. Another theorist called this the beginnings of what he called the global rift, that you have parts of the world that are relatively equal until 1492 or 1521 or 1532, around that period. And then suddenly you get one part of the world which becomes massively dominant over the other. And the legacy of that remains. So I think, yeah, you're absolutely right. The history, particularly of this period, is absolutely crucial to understanding the modern world and some of the problems we still have.
I'll just add briefly, I assume it was Inga Klendinen you studied with? One of the greatest joys of maybe of preparing for this talk was that I was able to justify rereading a lot of her work. And I was reminded just how good she was at showing things from a number of perspectives. When she was looking at the conquest, she was able to describe the actions of the Spaniards and how they would have come across to the Aztecs, and the actions of the Aztecs and how they would have come across or been misunderstood by the Spaniards. And I think this ability to try and see things from a variety of perspectives is something that is sadly lacking in many of our politicians. And I think even worse, people like Donald Trump wouldn't want to.
A question to both of you. If the Spanish hadn't invaded Central and South America, can you think about what the societies would have looked like 50 to 100 years after the period that you were looking at? So the Inca society seemed to be collapsing. Where was it going to? And I guess the same thing with the Aztecs.
It's one of the counterfactuals, the what-ifs of history, that you can never finally provide an answer for. But my view, certainly in the case of the Incas and probably the Aztecs as well, is if Europeans had arrived there don't know how long after, but possibly not too long after, the empires that they would have faced would have been different ones. I think in both cases you see really serious processes of disintegration, decay and division in both systems. Different kinds of empires, as Claudia mentioned, the Aztec one without much consolidation. So they have to continually reconquer areas in rebellion and missing out a few important areas on that map too. In the case of the Incas, they did consolidate, and that gave it a certain sort of strength, but it also provided a new source of conflict. So I think it's very likely that they would have faced different empires. In terms of where those societies in the longer term would have developed, I think it's really hard to say. Would they have undertaken the same sort of processes of social change as in Europe? I think that would have been a much longer process. That is, the development of large-scale markets, of some forms of proto-capitalism and so on. I don't think we see in the Americas much of that going on at the time.
Just going to briefly talk about one of those areas that the Aztecs didn't conquer, which, you know, really, really hurt them during the conquest. This is Tlaxcala. And they became, someone has called them the most important enemies of the Aztecs. And they had developed such hatred for Tenochtitlan that Cortes, who had seen them fight, actually described their actions and the final fights in Tenochtitlan as fierce and unnatural cruelty, his words. So this is the type of resentment that the Aztec Empire had created among its immediate neighbors, and you know, which really came to harm them at this stage. So I think this would only have grown. So yeah, chances are it would have been maybe a different empire, maybe it would have been Tlaxcala. Yeah,
question just down here.
Did the Aztecs build the city in Mexico?
How did they build the city?
How did they build it? Yeah. Oh, well, you know, that's an excellent question, because a lot of it was on water, and they reclaimed some of the water to build on it. And if you go to Mexico City today and you go into some of the old big buildings and you go down into the basements, you can still find water, and especially during earthquakes, this tends to be a problem. You know, we can't see it anymore today, but yes, it's built on water. It was an intense effort. Everything had to be brought in on boats, and eventually they built some causeways, and that made it easier, but still, boats were crucial.
I have one question. I am constantly amazed when I think about Pizarro or Cortez walking into Cusco, or walking into Aztec cities, and faced with the overwhelming numbers of people that were potentially hostile to them. I mean, balls.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, Cortes was, you know, he didn't have an alternative. It was as good as, you know, if he had gone back to Cuba. You know, he wasn't tasked with conquering. He was tasked with exploring. So he had broken everything, all directives, and Cuban governor actually sent an army after him. And Cortes, in the middle of conquering the Aztecs, had to deal with that. So, you know, turning back was not an option for him. He had to make this work, or, you know, he would die one way or another. And that was probably a very strong motivation.
And the men with him were in the same boat then. I mean,
by hook or by crook, yes.
Yeah, wow.
I think one of the things that it's important to understand is the ideological confidence of the Spanish in this period. Because, as Claudia mentioned, in Spain, they just concluded in 1492 with the defeat of the last Arab kingdom in Granada. In Spain, in 1492, they just completed the reconquest of Spain. So they have built a militant form of Christianity. A form of Christianity which is about conquest. Conquest is godly. That the spreading of Christianity is crucial across the world. And when you combine that with avarice and gold, it's a powerful mixture. By contrast, I think the two great empires that we've been looking at, as we've been emphasising, I think, were in a process of decay, which included a moral decay and a sense of cataclysm. I mean, there are millennial projections about people forecasting the end of the world, that the sun god, the sun may not come up, etc. The myth about Quetzalcoatl coming back is an end of the world myth. There's a similar one in the Andes with Viracocha, the creator of the world, who was said to have left, departed to the west, and would return at the end of the Inca ascendancy. And coincidentally, Pizarro approaches from the west. But there may have been many other predictions that haven't survived. This one just did survive because, coincidentally, that's what happened. But the predictions themselves are a sign of chaos and crisis in those societies. So I think the sense of confidence versus the sense of crisis is the key dynamic rather than just walls.
Amazing. Oh, sorry, we have one more. Time for one more question here. Yep.
I think it's quite ironic that the amount of gold that went back to Spain from both of the empires actually led to its own collapse.
Of course, there's a very important theorist, Earl J. Hamilton, American theorist, who... he deals with that question about the collapse of Spain. And yeah, that's right, that the gold, and more importantly later the silver actually, that goes back into Spain, basically flows out of Spain just as fast, because the places in Europe that are developing economically and developing sophisticated trading and manufacturing centres are not Spain. You know, they tend to be the Low Countries, Holland and Belgium, and then later parts of Germany and England. So the people, the places that are benefiting from the treasure are elsewhere than Spain. However, the really interesting thing is that what you have in Europe is a developing capitalism, but in a situation where you don't have developed capitalist institutions, financial institutions of trust. So very few people trust banks. You don't have bank notes because they're signed by a king. Why would you trust a king with your money? I mean, it's ridiculous. So before you have those trusted institutions, the only way in which a market can expand is by an increase in the supply of precious metals. And arguably, the vastly increased supply, particularly of silver, into Europe creates the possibility for capitalism to develop further in Europe. And without that, it would have been a slower process. There's also another argument about the price revolution, but I don't have time to go.
And you could say it's equally ironic then that, or you know, very telling in another way, that the treatment of the colonies then eventually led to this discontent that brought about the independence of the Latin American possessions of Spain, yeah, because they're just so unhappy of being bled dry and having nothing to do with it, no say, yeah.
Well, I'd like to thank Dr. John Minns and Dr. Claudia Hake for a fascinating lecture. That was fantastic. Please join me in thanking them.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.